Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Hardcore Listening Podcast.
What's up, folks?
That voice you hear there, that's Christopher Glasson.
And the other voice you hear, the one with the lisp, is Stuart Roy Whiffin.
Hello. We're recording this intro the day after we recorded the podcast. We're sitting in my car, in a car park, looking like a couple of...
dangerous loners.
That's what I was going to say.
Dangerous duet.
Yeah, yeah.
Today's
Doggers with Attitude.
Doggers with Attitude. Today's podcast is a funny one, but it's not funny in the sense of ha-ha. It's more funny in the sense that we barely talk in it.
Yeah.
Because of the guest and the guest's story, we kind of sat there open-mouthed, I think, would be the best way to describe
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was... The guest is a gentleman called Gary Hayes, who you probably don't know who he is. He's certainly not a celebrity as such. But Gary runs a charity set up from his on the back of his experiences. And his charity is called PTSD 999. And it's the next couple of hours of this podcast you're going to hear. We sort of said it would have been gratuitous to have said top five facts about, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder because it sounds like we're making light of it. Obviously we're not. So this podcast is basically Gary's story and Gary's story about those that have been in and around him that have been impacted either by the same PTSD or as a result of being a friend or a loved one of Gary's and the effect that he's suffering has had on them, and it's pretty intense, right?
Yeah, it is pretty intense. Gary's a lovely bloke. You can tell just from how passionately he talks about this, how much it means to him and how much it means to help others who have been in his situation. And we hear about his story, about how his career has fallen, like he's gone through the different phases.
From the military to the transport police, from close protection with the Royals and some life.
Yeah, it is. And it's just mad to hear. And even after the podcast, we talked and we spoke a bit more, we got into some more details that maybe we didn't think was appropriate for a podcast. And but they were absolute shocking things we heard.
Make no mistake, you're going to hear some very shocking things in the next couple of hours. Yeah, it's a very, very uncomfortable ride that Gary's been on.
Yeah, for sure. So it's a bit more of a serious one this time, but we didn't want to change the mood. We wanted to keep it earnest and quite serious. And I hope you guys enjoy it.
It's, absolutely.
It's here. We want to raise awareness for Gary's charity PTSD 999.
And you'll see all the links to that on all the social media postings and in the artwork accompanying this podcast. So do go over there and have a look and share a bit of love that
and
way.
And share some love there because there won't be top five things for you to share here. It's more sharing about the course. So, shout out to our sponsors, Love Beer, and our guys over at Bang Boom.
Yeah. Thanks to our producer, 76, for doing this. Thanks to Brad Acton for any video artwork you may see and John Harris for any artwork. Big love to the Distraction Pieces Network, and should we get on with it?
Yeah, let's crack on. Enjoy.
Please enjoy Hardcore Listening with Gary Hayes. It's a drunken soiree in the Whiffin. Chris and Stu present Hardcore Listening, the podcast.
We're recording.
Yeah. Welcome to Hardcore Listening. How is everybody? You good?
I'm all right, mate. Thanks. I just had a I've been eating really healthy.
Right.
Oh, excuse me.
Lovely. Great start. Burping straight in the mic.
And then I've had a jerk chicken burger from McDonald's.
How was that?
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Yeah.
McDonald's aren't sponsoring us this week. Smells good, right?
Yeah. So this is the first time in what, maybe about three weeks since we've had a guest in here.
Guest, yes.
Last one was last week's release, which was B Ducks.
Yeah.
That came out last week. So we've got a great guest this evening. It was introduced to us by a mutual friend, Mark Watts of White Room Studios. Let's big up his studio while we're chatting away. And today's guest is a different one, really. It's quite a strange one. Well, I'll tell you what, before I do anything, I'll introduce today's guest, which is Gary Hayes. How you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Gary, you've come here today to talk about your charity.
Yep.
And so your charity is called?
It's PTSD 999.
Okay. So that's based on post-traumatic stress,
and it's for emergency services. Back in 2014, I lost my job as a police officer with the British Transport Police, due to chronic PTSD. I went undiagnosed for possibly almost 8 years. And my PTSD goes back to the stuff that I did during the London bombings, or the aftermath of the London bombings.
All right.
Long and short, clearly as a police officer, and any member of the emergency services, you're dealing on a daily basis with traumatic events. And the brain's a very clever bit of kit. And when you're dealing with trauma, the brain will put all those nasty visions and thoughts that you've dealt with into let's just use a filing cabinet as a point of reference. And it just all gets shoved in there. Nothing's put in there sort of tidily or anything like that. And then everything else is put away cleanly, so you remember what you did 2 minutes ago, but the brain will try and stop you from remembering what you've just seen and stuff like that.
Okay.
So I dealt with, I would suggest, well over a good couple of hundred fatalities on the railway and other incidences as well, you know, stabbings, etc. And you just get on with it because it's your job.
Yeah. And you was a serviceman as well.
Yeah, I was in the army back in the mid-80s, served with the Royal Green Jackets. And I sort of, when I left that, I got married. And my wife was in the Met Police. Well, she was going into the Met Police when we met back in the late 80s, I think it was. And yeah, her career lasted 30 years. And she dealt with child protection issues. She did the normal stuff. As a bobby on the beat, learning your trade, as it were. But then she specialised, went into the sort of child offences and stuff like that. So you can imagine the catalogue of stuff that she's seen and dealt with. And, you know, likewise, when people think of post-traumatic stress, we instantly think of our servicemen and women.
Straight away.
You know. And quite clearly and rightly, when we see our boys and girls coming back from theatre, minus limbs, you know, terrible life-changing injuries. Everyone associates their mental state at that time almost immediately with post-traumatic stress. When you see the men and women who've come back from theatre with all their faculties, for want of a better word, nobody really thinks there's anything wrong because we can't see what's going on inside
their head. As an outsider, you just think they're home and safe, they're happy.
Absolutely. And, you know, for me, and I guess all the other guys in the emergency services, we know that we're going to come across some nasty stuff, and in some cases, some absolutely dreadful stuff.
Yeah.
And we accept that, but when you're continually dealing with traumatic events, this is when the problems start.
Yeah.
So throughout the duration of this podcast, what we do is we'll try and sort of anchor it with a few points.
Yep.
There's some facts about post-traumatic stress disorder. Just to sort of start, really, like how would you define it? What is, you know, if it's definable?
This is probably one of the biggest things about post-traumatic stress disorder or post-traumatic stress, as it's sort of more known as now, it's probably one of the most highly contested medical sort of diagnosis, because it's so hard to get that diagnosis, because, you know, as we start going through sort of like the sort of top five, as it were, post-traumatic stress isn't an immediate thing. You could deal with something, and clearly it could be quite nasty. Just for instance, say the stuff that I was dealing with in the mortuary after the 2005 bombings. I was part of a team to help identify all the victims and what was left of the bombers.
Bloody hell.
And
so you was in the ambulance service then?
No, I was a British Transport Police officer.
Right, okay.
And what it was, basically after the bombings, clearly everything went a bit nuts. And we got a major incident. So what we had to do, well, not me specifically, but the emergency services and the anti-terrorism command, I was part of our anti-terrorism team at the time. With each bomb location site, however you want to describe it, we had to set up four different pods. There was like four different sites for the sort of bombings, etc.
Yeah.
So we never had, and I can't remember anything other than, say, the bombings with the IRA,
mm-hmm.
where we've actually had to establish a temporary mortuary to deal with the fatalities, body parts. The forensic side of it was incredible. So we've got this set up. We've got four pods. So because I was an ex-squaddy, for some bizarre reason, they thought it was acceptable to send me to the mortuary.
To deal with that.
Yeah, because they just think, oh, because you're a squaddy, you've been in the infantry, you've seen it, been, you know, been there.
You'll be fine to deal with it.
Yeah.
Another day in the office.
Absolutely. And for me, I sort of questioned it, but it was like, you know, I just don't get the connection between being an ex-serviceman and going to the mortuary. I went, well, we need a sergeant down there. I said, well, I'm not a sergeant. I went, congratulations. I was promoted in the field. And we need you to run one of the teams down there, because the people that were going down there weren't lasting, because what they were dealing with was absolute, it was horrific.
Yeah.
Now, just taking that back a wee bit, when we talk about post-traumatic stress and how it can manifest itself, my wife at the time had been heavily pregnant with our third son. And thankfully, a little sod come about a week and a half, 2 weeks early. Had he not, she would have been on the Allgate train that got blown up. We married that, well, we got that down to within minutes, and it's, we both concluded that that was probably where she would have been, because she was a police officer at Holborn Police Station at the time. So that was bearing on in mind, and clearly, you know, seeing the effects, the bomb blasts on the victims. You know, the victims have been down in some of them tunnels 3-4 days, and if you remember back then, we had a really hot summer as we just experienced. So decomposition was quite rapid.
Right. So sensory overload.
Oh, big time. You know, I dealt with people under trains and stuff, don't get me wrong. That is a nasty old business in itself. Yeah. However, to get bodies coming to you in the manner that they were, and we never had proper refrigeration, freezers. So we were putting these pods that we had, unfortunately, whilst they were cool, weren't really cool enough to stop or slow down the decomposition process. So you can imagine when you open a bag, you're basically with some of the people.
Is there any way to combat against the sort of, like, because I can't imagine that the smell must be absolutely, is there nothing they could put under your nose or
all this stuff with Vicks and all that?
I don't know, this is me just asking.
It's a good question. It's the smell's there, it will never go. I could go anywhere. I walk past a butcher's shop and I'll get a whiff
really?
Of that, and I'll be sick, or I'll think I'm going to be sick.
Yeah.
Because it takes me back
takes
to,
back
not necessarily there, but other mortuaries and dead bodies and stuff. And my old partner, bless him, we used to kill ourselves laughing. We'd go out on jobs and whatever, and we might have had a fatality the day before, and clearly you change your kit and all that.
Yeah.
And he goes, you know, can you smell that? I'm like, what are you on about? He said, that smell.
Mm-hmm.
What smell? And again, because I didn't understand post-traumatic stress and how it manifests itself, I would start laughing. Now, only back in the summer of this year, we were at a friend's barbecue, and he said the same thing to me. Now, he's still in the police, And do you know what? When he said it, I try not to think about it, but I've got to go. I said, I can't stay. We both, and, you know, lived across the road from this guy's party, so that's where we went. Because we both were sort of, dare I say, re-experiencing a trauma. So, with the mortuary stuff, yeah, there was nothing to prepare you for that. And all we did was, and bearing in mind I had a team to look after as well, so you put yourself on the back burner a wee bit and you're concentrating on your team. So of everything that we dealt with in there, my focus was looking after my team, making sure they were all right. And you just got on with it.
What point did you start, did it start creeping in to you then? When did you start, when did the, say, maybe the subconscious or whatever start, like, making you process it once the sort of the stress of the situation was over and everyone was...
Because, you know, I mean... Just to interject a little bit there as well, like, because for me, like, just taking it to a more a personal level for something that I can relate to, saying the powers in comparison. But, you know, if I see I work in the nightclubs, and if I see like a brutal fight outside a club and something where I have to involve myself in, I'll get home and I can't sleep and I'm laying there and my heart's still racing and I'm trying to... And that will take me a bit of time, and I'll have a glass of wine or something like that to kind of just try and calm myself down and go to bed. What was that like coming home that night? Like, you know, before sorry to interrupt there, Chris, but before it creeps in to like how it started to creep in, how, like initially that night, how did you sort of try to digest what was going on?
I think with that question, so I was coming home from where the temporary mortuary was at the Honourable Artillery Company, just at the other end of Shoreditch. And it was quite funny in some respects because, you know, I've left all that mess behind after working in those conditions for 14, 15 hours a day, which we did in the early phases. And I guess because I'd had the benefit of experience dealing with, you know, people trapped under trains or, you know, through suicide, you know, whether it be on the underground or the main line, and they're two different sort of entities, I was used to it. But this is, again, where you have to ask yourself, what's normal to one person is certainly not normal to someone else. So in that respect, you know, I could understand why some of the people that were going to the mortuary couldn't hack it. And that, you know, doesn't deflect on them as being good human beings or coppers or whatever else. I just sort of closed my mind to it, and it, you know, I personally didn't make a personal connection with the deceased. Some people do. So, you know, going home, my focus was going home to a new baby, my two other little fellas at the time, and obviously making sure the wife was okay. But listening to people... being people on the train going home, all cussing and cursing about the emergency services this, the emergency services that, the trains are all shit because of the bombings, and, you know, they need to get home. And it just bizarrely made my day's experience, and I was there for nearly 8 weeks at the end, I think, pale into insignificance because I found it a little bit humorous listening to people whinging. And I was sort of like, do you know, if you'd have just spent 2 seconds near the place where I've worked, because the smell was horrific, and I kid you not, it was awful. You know, you might wind your neck in a bit and choose to be a bit more, how can I put it, delicate with what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know. So I tried not to get too focused on what we were doing. And probably later on I'll explain where my PTSD comes from. You know, because I needed to get home, I needed to give the wife some downtime, and my focus would then be the kids and a new one. So I would forget about what I'd done, but simply I hadn't forgotten about it. I put it in that filing cabinet with all the other mess just to be filed away because I couldn't tell my wife what I'd been doing that day.
Yeah.
Because it was horrible.
No, of course.
You know, with post-traumatic stress disorder, it doesn't necessarily manifest itself straight away. So what you were saying about being in a fight or seeing something like that happen, again, that's a normal reaction. And, you know, fight or flight thing kicks in. Yeah. And then when you've come away from witnessing that, that could be for you the most traumatic thing you've ever seen in your life. Because again, what's normal for you might not be normal for someone else, and vice versa. But you've experienced that bit of anxiety, that rush of adrenaline, and you're thinking, Jesus Christ, if this goes tits up, you know, what do I do? How do I react to it? Or do you throw yourself in there and get involved?
Yeah.
Or do you do the sensible thing and let the bouncers get in? Because that's what you get paid for.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
But again, that's something that you, not necessarily that night, 2 days after, a week after, think about. But you could just pick up a newspaper and that might trigger that thought again. And this is where sort of like the PTSD starts coming into its own. And PTSD is often misdiagnosed because it can take so long for it to, you know, show the signs and symptoms, which there are many variants of. And it's often misdiagnosed as depression and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Because it's such a difficult thing to get on top of, you know. I certainly didn't know I was suffering for a number of years. I learned to drink at a very early age when I was a kid in the army, because that's all we did, you know, back in the day. We wouldn't think nothing of it because we were all super fit. You know, nice 30-inch waist back in the day with my own hair and teeth. It was wonderful. But as you get older, you know, sometimes you try and moderate what you're doing. And if there was any sort of like common indicator for me, I started drinking really heavily. But I just I put that down to all the stresses and strains of being a cop.
Yeah.
I joined the job very late in life. I think I was 34 when I joined. So I'd had a bit of experience in sort of the various work places that I found myself in, from the military to close protection work and you know, all stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, an example, I remember a wife coming home when I was sort of really starting to struggle. Now,
that kind of pulls into what Chris was saying. So how far after then
it was? I would suggest, so 2005 was the bombings. 2012.
Wow.
And the only reason say that, to be quite specific, we were fortunate enough as a family, we went away on holiday to America. And we went about 3 years prior to 2012. And we were able this time to have 3 amazing weeks. And so in 2012, that made my little fella 5, or 6. And the other boys would have been sort of 13, 14, and probably a year younger than that. And I remember the wife didn't like to drive out in America, so I'd drive everywhere. And we'd had a particularly long day doing the theme park things. And my little lad came up to me and he just went, "Dad." So I went, "Yeah." He said, "You don't make me laugh anymore." You know, you just think, "You little shit."
Yeah.
It's cost me an arm and a leg to be out here. So I just pushed him in the pool in the villa, which I found quite humorous. And the other 2 boys come up as he's floundering, because then I remembered he couldn't swim properly. So, you know, it's like that moment of, oops. I said, "You better get in and get him." So I pushed them in. And they go and they went, "You know, Dad, Sam's right. You're not funny anymore." And I was like, I got a bit angry. And then a wife came up to the side and she said, "You know, they're right." And I sort of threw...
Well, that must have been a lot to take.
Yeah, I threw a few choice words into her. And things were starting to turn over in my head a bit. And midway through the holiday, my partner from work rang me up. He says, "When you get back, gal," he said, "you better get your grab kit because you're going on a search." I don't know if you remember, back in 2012, a little Welsh girl, April Jones, who was kidnapped and murdered. McKinliffe.
Yeah. It was in the river?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were part of a search team that went and looked for her. So
I was there when that search team was there.
Wow. So, yeah, that was a multi...
Did they find the killer?
Oh, they've got the killer. Yeah. He's in jail now. Right. We didn't find anything of April. You know, and again, with that scenario, April's mum and dad were there every morning at the search cell to welcome in all the cops. So it was a multinational search team. you know, we get into the search cell, sort of 6:30 in the morning.
It was a massive stretch of river, wasn't it?
Huge. But we were also searching all the wooded areas and around the, you know, Brecon and whatever else. And, you know, clearly we would love to have found something of April just to give that back to the parents just for a bit of closure.
Sure.
So, you know, Mum and Dad would be there in the morning. We'd be out as long as natural daylight would allow us to be, and we were searching in some pretty horrendous places. And we'd come back, and Mum and Dad would be there with a mug of tea and all that kit. And then, because it was a Christmas week, all April school friends came up to see us, and they'd give us Christmas cards and little presents. Now, bearing in mind, a lot of us up there were parents. So you got all that racing through your head, besides everything else you've done, and this is just like the tip of the iceberg stuff. And on the last day, we went to April school, so we promised the kids we'd pop in and see them, and had a mess about on the van and all that, and we'd give them some kit. And the headmistress, I've forgotten her name now, we'd all been wearing like these pink ribbons for April.
That's right, yeah. And all over all the road signs.
That's it, everywhere you went. And the people on McKinliffe were just brilliant. I mean, we'd go into the shops afterwards looking like a sack of shit. We were soaked wet through, covered in mud and all that kit. And whatever we wanted, they'd just give it to us. They were so overwhelmed with, you know, they could see how passionate we were about looking for her. So, again, we did that and we come home. And it was probably the quietest five-hour drive I've ever had with a hooligan van full of coppers.
Yeah.
Not one person said anything. Everyone was in, you know, stuck in their own sort of thoughts. And you get back to work, you debug the van, you sort your kit out, and you're back to work again. No one would say anything, you know. So again, when you say post-traumatic stress, how does it sort of leap out and get you, and what is it? I really cannot give you an answer. I'm not clinically trained.
Mm.
I've just got chronic post-traumatic stress. That was the diagnosis given to me. So, you know, I know the symptoms that I had and that I've shown. And when I look at other people now, I can see, and it pisses a lot of people off because, you know, I don't say to them, oh, you've got it, because that'd be, you know, completely wrong to do that. However, I can see some of the traits and where I was. And I sort of just say to my mates, my ex-colleagues, you know, we're always here if you need us to phone up. We go on our website. There's self-help sort of bits and pieces of information on there for you. And we get it. Whereas, sadly, the emergency services simply don't. And they won't ever admit to post-traumatic stress being an injury on duty, which it clearly is.
Yeah.
Because it would open them up to a lot of litigation. And, you know, could you imagine if this was American, I'd turn around to whichever part of the police service I was working with out there and said to them, right, I've lost my job, I've lost everything, it's your fault.
They'd be hit with 1,000 shoots.
Yeah. You imagine the dollars coming my way because they hadn't had that duty of care. So, you know, going off at a tangent a wee bit with regard to the charity, we're not beating any part of the emergency services up. All we're saying is you really need to look at your policies and your procedure around your men and women going out daily and dealing with trauma.
Yeah.
My nephew's just, he started in the force, and not long into that, he started to have to deal, he's quite a sensitive lad anyway, and I don't think he was prepared to see what he ended up starting to see. No. You know, I mean, he's only 21 now, and it's the same for, you know, he's seen, obviously, you will end up seeing dead bodies and whatnot, classic, my phone going off. But yeah, and it's the same for my mate in the fire service, you know, like the stuff he's seen on railways and stuff like that, and not that, but just in houses and that.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, nothing ever prepares you for that sort of stuff.
You know, I mean, I've got so many variants of incidents that I could give you. I mean, I remember we had a job at Bethnal Green. A young girl had thrown herself in front of a Central Line train. And she'd done a good job. She, you know.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Dead as a dodo, for want of a better word. Yeah. Mm. But we couldn't get her from behind the train. She'd actually managed to be struck by the front of the train. And, you know, there's not a lot of space between the tunnel wall and the side of the tube.
Yeah.
But she managed to get wedged between the tube wall and the live rail. So unfortunately, not only had she been smashed to pieces, she was also cooked. Because we couldn't get the power source off quick enough. And this firefighter came down. He was the first one down. And me and my mate, unfortunately, we were like the Burke and Hare of the British Transport Police. We could go on shift and we could guarantee you that we would end up dealing with a dead body, part of a dead body, or someone who's about to become a dead body.
Yeah.
You know, it was that sort of scenario.
Yeah.
And this poor fireman come down, and it was almost like a Scooby-Doo moment. As he's come down down the escalators onto the platform area, he sort of come in, and because I could hear all this crashing and banging, I've turned round, and this lad almost skidded. It was a bizarre thing to watch.
Yeah.
And then it nearly collapsed because the platform area was getting a bit smoky, but that was due to the poor girl. And I sort of looked at him, and the colour just drained out of him.
Yeah.
And his mate come down, and I said, better get him upstairs. So I took him upstairs, and we managed to get this poor girl from between the train and all that. And I said to one of the other firefighters, is your mate all right? And he went, yeah, he says, don't you remember that job we had like a little while ago? And it was about, we had another one with that watch, funny enough. And I was like, yeah. And he said, oh, that was his nephew.
Oh, God.
And the same sort of scenario. Mm. And that was him. And I think it wasn't long after that I think he left the service. So again, you know, what's normal for us, and I use the term loosely, is clearly not normal for other people. So, you know, whether you've been the fire service, the ambulance service, or the police, it's, especially for the roads police and the British Transport Police, you're dealing with multiple, sometimes, fatalities. And it is just sadly normal to us. You know, the first fatality I dealt with, it looked and certainly didn't smell and sound anything like the grainy training video that I'd had.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And I must admit, when I first looked at this person under the train, I went through every emotion that you possibly could. I didn't want to be there. I wanted to be sick. I didn't want to look, but that morbid curiosity gets you.
Oh,
and then you're being told, well, you've got to get down there and get amongst it and pull it out. And you're like, really?
I want to go home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Seriously. And then you deal with it, and you're in shock. There's no doubt. But you know what? The next one that I went to after that, it was normal.
Yeah.
And I've dealt
with... It's crazy how the brain
it
works that quickly to, like, make that feel
normalise it.
Absolutely. You know, and every job that I went to thereafter, you can imagine someone being hit by a mainline train that goes, say, from whether it be the sea to sea, which is local to us, or you're at the main Liverpool Street South End. When someone gets hit by one of those trains or a freight train, there's not a lot left.
No.
Hmm.
With a tube, sometimes, I would suggest probably a majority of the time, a person often survives.
Hmm.
Right.
But with life-changing injuries.
Yeah.
Clearly it's better if they don't survive because you haven't got part with the screaming and all that. And that in itself, again, is something different.
Fucking
but
hell,
you
man.
Just... You know,
I just don't think people really like all the jobs that we have. Like most of us do not see behind the curtain of what like less than 1% of us do on a daily basis, and that blows my mind. Like, what was it? I was watching. This isn't emergency services, but I was doing a bit of research for something else the other day, and it was about the prison service and what the wardens have to do.
Yeah,
and it was a review of a certain prison about 3 years ago, and what they were going through, these wardens, was just on a day-to-day basis was fucking mental.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not having to deal with fatalities, but I mean, again, it's still a small portion of our population who aren't doing we do a podcast. it's not difficult, is it? It might be stressful, like not this, but our other jobs, but it's nothing in the same level.
And I was just thinking, he said, you know, what does, you know, London Underground put in place for the drivers?
Do you know what? And again, it was always, it made us laugh because the drivers, whether it be on the LU or the main line, they are looked after so well.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, to be fair, I mean, you imagine driving your train one day, and I think the best way to describe this would be, without being too graphic, would be you're driving your car down a motorway and you get a fly at the windscreen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're driving your train at 90 miles an hour from Liverpool Street to Southend. Sometimes it's not a fly that it's your windscreen.
Yeah.
Same with the tube drivers. You know, bear in mind that these guys can't turn left or right or stop immediately. There's a lot of weight behind them. And, you know, when we turn up to jobs, one of the first things you have to do, technically, would you believe, is breathalyse the driver.
Right, yeah, it figures.
You know, common sense would say, well, I get that, but... Really, this poor
bigger
bloke,
fish to fry,
or woman
yeah.
has just technically ended someone's life.
Mm.
You imagine the shock that they've just gone through or gone through at that time. And we turn up, and you know, very often the driver would have called the job in. That's how we get notified, unless a member of the staff saw it or a member of the public. And they're virtually taken away. We get a first account from them. Just to ensure that nobody was near the person or around the person or any other person's, you know, suggest that they might have been pushed or whatever. And it's a horrible thing to say. It makes the job a bit easier because then you're dealing with a non-suspicious incident.
Yeah.
And you can just get to work. Get the person from under the train, off the train,
not
wherever.
Forensics and stuff like
that. Yeah, you haven't got to worry about that. It's a suicide.
Yeah.
You know, the ambulance people will turn up. And sometimes fire service would turn up, and we can't pronounce, I say we, in my former career, I as a police officer couldn't pronounce death. It would have to come from a paramedic. They would turn up, put the old heart monitor thing on, and clearly there would be a flat line, and they would sort
of... Did you know that most of the time? Was it a bit bleak? Like everyone was like, we're doing this because we have to, but...
Yeah, and do you know what?
That must make it hard as well.
It is, because... you know, there's no written rule to say that we, as a British Transport Police officer, should get down into the 4 foot, which is like, if you imagine the running rails, that's the what they call 4 foot, it's the distance between the rails, and pick up bits of a person, or big bits and small bits.
Yeah.
It's the accepted thing.
Approximately, I know you can't put an exact sort of number on it, but like, how frequent was this happening?
If I was to say you, in one shift, we have three.
In a shift?
Oh, hold on, what, sorry. A night?
A day.
A day, sorry, what,
that was that was an exceptional, no, not every day, that was an exceptional shift.
An average week?
An average week, you could have two.
Oh, bloody hell.
So a couple of years ago...
I presume it might be one every couple of months.
No. Because you only ever think of your line, didn't you?
Yeah. Like, well, this is it. And as a national sort of police service, I think... And I'm not going to say this is a precise quote and figure. I think there was 300, nearly 400 fatalities on a network nationally. So that's over one a day.
Yeah.
You know.
Crazy.
Those people clearly are in a bad place.
Yeah.
And, you know, to take your life in that manner, and again, I've seen all the different variants of how to do it and be successful, and for some people to be not very successful and have life-changing injuries as a result. So, yeah, it is just having a bit of a gallows sort of humour towards what you're doing.
Yeah, of course.
I remember, you know, we had, say, the shift where my mate and I, we sort of had this, three in a day. We got cancelled for the third one, because obviously the two other ones that we'd been to were quite messy.
Yeah.
And we basically got home a bit sharpish, and our little British Legion club's down a literally 2-minute walk from the station and 3-minute either way for both of us where we lived. And we got in there, and I think within 30 minutes we'd sunk about 6 pints.
Yeah.
Hadn't said a word to...
Yeah.
You know, normally we have a bit of a cuss and a curse and whatever.
Yeah. And how do you rationalise that, though? You can't, can you?
No, and do you know what? My mate said to me, he said, that was horrible, wasn't it? And I went, yeah, do you want another beer? And we had another beer and went home.
Yeah.
And that was our debrief for each other, as it were. So, you know, every situation has its own little story, you know. But then we'd often, after we'd dealt with a fatality, you'd have to go and deliver a death message as well.
Oh, fuck.
So you've
that's
got
your job as well?
Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, unlike, I'll use the Metropolitan Police, because they're such a big force. I think at the moment they've got sort of some 30,000 officers, where for the British Transport Police, I think there's less than 3,000 nationally. So to have specifically trained officers, what I call FLOs, which are like family liaison officers, they're very far and few between. So again, it's not right, but you would often, having picked up all the bits and pieces of the deceased, put them in the mortuary, you know, dealt with all that, got personal belongings, you'd have to search the body or what's left of the bodies as well. And then once you'd established who that person was and where they lived, you'd then go to the home address.
Same day?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, as quick as humanly possible.
But surely surely you shouldn't be in a position mentally to be put on that extra...
I don't think that's fair, is it?
Do you know what I mean? To be having to deal with that, and then now you've got to go and deal with the family of the deceased as well. I mean, how can a human being digest that? Yeah.
It's a tough thing. I mean, I think it's quite a recent quote. I've probably seen more deaf and disrupted bodies than your average frontline infantry soldier, you know, has, even with current, you know, or events over the last few years with the, you know, the Gulf War and Afghan and all the rest, you know. So for guys, and I'll use what's now the Rifles, took our name, the Royal Green Jackets. So this year alone, unfortunately, I think it's either 48 or 49 men from my old regiment have taken their lives through post-traumatic stress. That's this year alone. When you look at America, 22 cops, stroke ex-servicemen, take their lives a week. And what they're doing, I mean, there's a friend of mine, he's a retired lieutenant or lieutenant, whatever they call themselves, and he emails me on a regular basis. And these boys and girls are going into work, and clearly they're carrying firearms, and they'll sit in a briefing and just take out their service revolver and blow their heads off. They feel secure in the environment they're in, but because they're in such a dark place, that's it. And they'll just take their lives there and then, or they'll go to part of the car park within the sort of police area and do it there. So, you know, going back to what was asked earlier on, how does it manifest itself? Very often it doesn't. And, you know, it's just person could become withdrawn, drink a lot.
Was your wife sort of saying anything to you at this point? And was, you know, was there any kind of...
I think she started noticing a difference. She came home from work one day and said, the size of me now, I'm the only one who clearly does cooking indoors. she came home and she went to the fridge to get some stuff out to do some cooking. And she opened the fridge and she, like, went into one. And I was like, what's the matter with you? All this fucking booze in here, all this blah, blah. And I was like, what's the matter with you? It's just a drink. But when I look back at it now, it wasn't. I think all the room that was left in the fridge was for some butter and a bit of sliced cheese.
Some craft. I filled it up with beer. Cheese singles.
Yeah, I filled it up with beer, Jack Daniels, wine. And she, and rightly so, yeah, she freaked out.
Yeah.
Mm. And I, at that time, though, I, for me, was just like, stop being stupid, you know.
Yeah.
And again, I just turned around. It was an easy thing to do. I blamed it on the job because, you know, one minute I'm on my hands and knees looking for IEDs for, you know, the threat of terrorism. The following day I'm looking after the royal family. I'm doing searches for the royal family. You know, the next day I'm dealing with the general public. The day after that I might have a stabbing to deal with. You know, you think of every sort of range or experience you can go through as a police officer, then that was our daily routine. But it's
really, you're really rarely ever showing up to something that's, there's a positive event that's happened. It's always
all high level stress constantly, yeah, isn't it?
And it is. And again, with post traumatic stress, it's because you're on a regular basis, you're dealing with trauma. And there's no easy way of dealing with it other than throwing it in that filing cabinet, excuse me, and trying to just forget about it.
Yeah.
And you move on. You know, now I look back on the way that I was horrible. My two eldest boys, bless them, they took the brunt of it. You know, I was shouting and screaming at the wife and the kids. Kids are kids.
Yeah.
But if my oldest lad said something, I'd be all over him. And then the middle lad, I'd be all over him. And I'd shout and scream at him. And I've brought something with me. I doubt if I'll be able to read it. There's two statements. And one's from my wife. And one's from my oldest lad. And when we do our presentations to the police, fire and ambulance or whatever else, we often, you know, we do all the introductory bits and pieces.
Yeah.
And then one of our patrons is Graham Cole. He used to be on the bill.
Yeah.
Played Tony Stamp.
Mm-hmm.
I've known Graham for, blimey, some 20-odd years. We're real good mates. And that friendship only came about because I used to do extra stuff on the bill. I used to do all the firearm stuff and putting the doors in. And Graham will, because Graham knows me wife and he knows me boys, and he would read these two statements, and he wouldn't have to do anything theatrical. He would just read them, and you could tell that he was getting upset because he knew me wife and me kids. And then, you know, myself and Simon, the other co-founder, we would get up and go for our part of the presentation. And then I would refer back to the statements and I would say, you know, because everyone's going through this absolute helter-skelter ride of emotion. And, you know, people cry in our presentations. It's not our thing to go out and upset people, no. But because you're hitting certain triggers for them and it's a realisation. And I would just turn around and say, all right, the statement from the wife of a sufferer, well, chronic sufferer, that was my wife. And you're looking at people, and again, you're going through this whole range of emotion. And then when I tell them about the kid, some of them already got it, and I say, that's my oldest son. Now, for your oldest son to turn around and say he hated you coming home, he dreaded you coming home because of your temper, your violent screaming and shouting. I mean, I was never physically abusive to my wife and children. I say that with my hand on my heart. but I was one angry badger.
Yeah.
And it was often drink induced, or, you know, I'd just come in and then I'd just see one of them and I would just let them have it. I would shout and scream. And, you know, my oldest boy was worried about mum and dad getting divorced and, you know, because you hear all these stories, didn't you? He was worried about the effect I was having on his brothers. And clearly, it was driving him away. I look back on it now, and again, it's probably one of the key reasons that Simon and I... Simon's a chronic sufferer as well from the stuff that he saw during the Balkans conflict, and he saw some horrific stuff out there. You know, and I sort of look back now...
How did you meet?
Through the military. Right. We've known each other a number of years. Simon came out of the parachute regiment as a captain, and we'd had paths across through various sort of connections and whatever else. And Simon was with me during my darkest times, and even when I went to take my own life.
It got there?
Oh, yeah, yeah, oh, yeah. When I lost my job in 2014, it, yeah. I'd gone from being this...
Was that losing your job in the police?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd gone from being this extrovert to one horrible individual. I didn't want to be around people. I couldn't stand people. I was very short-tempered. You know, I couldn't go out with a family. I couldn't use the public transport systems because of stuff that I'd seen. And, you know, you're always training as well, especially on the old anti-terrorism side of life. And some of the stuff that we'd sat down and watched. And again, it's a manifestation of post-traumatic stress where it's like hyper-arousal and stuff like that. And it's not in a sexual sense.
Yeah.
It's you become so overly aware of what's going on around
right.
you. I can't go into a pub or a restaurant there. As long as I can see a door, I'm not too
God,
bad.
Yeah.
But I'm always checking people out. I'm always looking at the exit and entry points, you know. And the wife used to go mad because she said, it looks like you're out for a fight.
Yeah, you can't unwind.
And you can't. And it's, you know, going back to the little story when I was out in America, we broke down. We was going to Gatorland, and we broke down, thankfully, outside of quite a posh residence. However, to get another hire car was like some 2 hours away. And all of a sudden, I become very aware of all these cars just cruising by, young kids wearing colours, as they do over here.
Mm.
And I'm thinking, we're going to get turned over.
Mm. Yeah.
And so I'm there pacing up and down. I'm on the phone to the car hire company. And I was about 30 metres away from the car, and we've been there a couple of hours now. And this car pulled up alongside. And the driver was wearing colours, but he was talking to my wife. And I come running over. He sped off. Excuse me. She went nuts at me. She said, what the hell's the matter with you? I said, what was he doing? Oh, I've gone into one.
Hmm.
He was trying to help her. But he see me coming over like a born a china shop.
And thought, fuck that.
Yeah, and he buggered off. So, yeah, again, I didn't even know, but there's another sign, you know, that I was struggling. Going back to daily routine in the job, I'd had a particularly nasty job down at Ilford, which started off very innocently. We had a little police office on the station, and myself and my mate were just coming out, going to the vehicle, parked outside the station, and this old deer had fallen down the last couple of steps onto the platform. So we've just gone over to help her, and the station supervisor come out and he said, oh, it's all right, girl, leave it. He said, it's a station accident, I'll deal with it. And this guy come over, he went, yeah, he said, I'll see her fall down the last couple of stairs. She didn't want any help from me. He said, and thanks for doing what you're doing. And I was like, oh, cheers, fella, no worries. And then he walked away. Then me and Mick walked upstairs and we got to the top of the stairs and we heard this almighty bang. And we just looked at each other and was like, really? And then one of our little probationary cops come up, Sarge, I think there's someone under a train.
Uh-huh.
So I was like, no shit, Sherlock. Because as we walked back down the stairs, if you could imagine the flights of stairs, a tunnel, it was just covered in body matter. And sort of got down onto the platform. The train had stopped about 400 or 500 yards down the track. And you just think, oh, here we go again. So I've called it in. But you know, you just go, where's that geezer? So I've gone into the sort of office, the supervisor's office, to have a quick look at the CCTV. And it was a bloke who said, thanks very much for what you're doing.
Jesus Christ.
And you know, you just think, there was no sign.
What do you think?
And that's it. You know, the only thing I thought of straight away, and it's a selfish thing, was like, A, we weren't around him, so no one could have accused us of pushing him. And thankfully, on viewing the CCTV, you know, it's quite clear this gentleman took his own life.
Yeah.
So, again, when we're going through the process of establishing the fact that, you know, he was deceased, we've got as much of him in the body bag as we could, put him in the local mortuary, and it's then you've got to go and deliver that death message. And, you know, there's another one near Christmas, and this gentleman lived not far from here, and went there, knocked on the door, and it was, you know, one of those calls or jobs that you hated doing, because all I could hear was the kids running at the door, Mum, Dad's home, blah, blah.
Fuck.
And you just think that, and what should happen, should be two of you.
Yeah.
Because obviously it can be very distressing.
Yeah.
And I was on with Todd. And this kid opened a door, and straight away there's a copper in his front door, and he was young enough but wise enough to know that there was something wrong. A lovely big ass. I'll never forget, he went to me, where's my fucking dad? And he was only about 10 or 11. So probably about the age of my oldest lad. I went, is your mum in? And he went, where's my dad? Where's my fucking dad? And I'm thinking, it's bizarre. But as I looked over his shoulder on the hallway, I could see some family photographs. And this guy was clearly in that photograph, because I had some ID of his. And then his other little brother come running up, who was probably about the age of my middle lad. And then just to top it off, the little sister come running up, yeah, who was probably about the same age as Jesus my youngest Christ. Boy. So they're all looking at me. And then Mum put her head round the door, and she knew what had happened. And so I've had to go in, explain to her what had happened. Then she asked if I could go and tell the kids what had happened to their dad.
Fucking hell.
And, you know, in between trying to get members of her family or the neighbours to come and sit with her, I'm now trying to explain to these kiddies that, you know, Dad ain't coming home ever again. It's probably the shittiest Christmas you're ever going to have. And I'm apologising for having to give him this bad news. And, you know, you're just thinking, how are these kids going to deal with that? And I must have been there, because what you don't do, you don't give yourself a period of time. That will take as long as it needs to take. And you leave them with the appropriate telephone numbers and your number, should they want to call, blah, blah, blah. And then she said to me, can you go and tell his mum?
Well,
so I was like, yeah, all right. And she lived round the corner, about half a mile down the road. And I pulled up in my police car, and just sort of get myself ready to go and do the whole process again. Because there's no sort of strict way of giving that message. You just, if there's an appropriate thing to say and do, you try and do your best. And I see a curtain go, and then the window open, and this woman shouted out at me, it's your fucking fault, you killed him. And then she smashed the window closed. And of course, because of the noise of the window getting closed, all the neighbours all of a sudden like, what's going on? And the curtains are twitching. And she came flying down the stairs, and she opened the door, and I was about 2 foot off the front door. And she punched me square in the chest. Now, I was a little bit lighter than I am now, but that punch was enough to rock me on my feet, and I sort of went back. And I stood there, and she went ballistic at me, absolutely ballistic, and smashed the door closed, and that was that. So I'm sort of thinking, right, I know that she lives alone. I've got to make sure, you know, I've got a duty of care towards her now. And she just told me there and then, fuck off, do one. I don't want you near me. You've killed my son. So I was sort of like trying to take that on board, and then I got on the radio, and this is the job for you. So I said, right, can you show the second death message delivered at such and such time? My control was like, yeah, yeah. I said, all right, is that matter all dealt with now? I said, well, yeah, until like, you know, tomorrow when we pick up the other bits and pieces and do what we've got to do to get the file put together for coroner and the rest of it. I went, okay, good. Can you go to Romford Station? We've got what we call a ticket irregularity, i.e. someone's just tried to travel without buying a train ticket. And I'm like, yeah. Right.
So bit of a difference.
Yeah, but that was what you did.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it's a bizarre old... bizarre old game, for want of a better word.
So, Gary, we it's so fascinating. We could go on different angles of this because, I don't know, it's just something that you don't hear enough about about. And before we talk about your the charity that you've yep. started, we were going to do top five facts yep. of PTSD.
Okay.
So, shall we do a couple of those now and then maybe move on? So
I think we can just throw a few in, yeah. I think it's just... important, and we just keep, you know.
This is sort of by no means a top five list from any specific place. It's
yeah,
just a top five that
yeah.
I thought of. Might not be completely right.
Yeah.
Who knows? So we spoke earlier on about signs and symptoms, and these can literally come on years after that traumatic event or a series of traumatic events, and it's not, you know, something that might show itself immediately after when we spoke about the fight at a club or something yeah. like that. Sometimes it can take weeks, months, if not years, to manifest itself. And it can come through as an anxiety or a depression or in the form of flashbacks, which I suffer lightly. Thankfully, I'm managing that. But it's every day I still have moments, night times. Thankfully, it's getting less now, but I went through a period where I was, my dreams and flashbacks were so vivid and real that I was being sick. Jesus. I didn't know that was another side of post-traumatic stress, but I spoke to a professor, some Greek chap, a couple of years ago, and he just laughed when I told him I was being sick, because my wife thought I was back on the booze again, you know, being ill and all the rest of it. And he said, no, he said, that's quite a common thing. And I thought, I wish someone had told me.
Common, yeah.
You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah.
No one's so, exactly. Saying, yeah. And again, it's just another side. The list is endless in relation to the way PTSD yeah. can manifest itself. Now, apparently, there was an American Psychological Association that said women were more prone to PTSD than men.
Okay.
And that goes to basically women that have been sexually assaulted, sexually abused.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly that is a very traumatic yeah. experience for that lady, and clearly something that they will relive daily.
Yeah.
Now, for me, what I found out was that often to post-traumatic stress, there's, dare I say, a root cause where it all starts to manifest itself. So, for me, dealing with all them fatalities and the stuff with the bombings and everything else I did, it was secondary. Because as a child, I was sexually abused. Now, I never told anyone, and probably I didn't tell my wife for years. Well, for absolute years.
Yeah.
And we was at one of her sort of like team functions, and there was a guy who was a bit less compassionate than others.
Yeah.
And he said something about some kids, and basically they brought it all on themselves about being abused.
Oof.
And I hadn't even had a drink, and I went ballistic.
Yeah, of course.
And of course, when the wife finally caught up with us, I mean, I was going to knock this. I wasn't in the job then.
Yeah.
I was going to kill this geezer. Absolutely. Because it just all sort of, where it came from, I don't know. Because I hadn't told anyone.
Yeah.
You know, not even my parents or my siblings. And just this absolute outburst of rage. Pure rage.
Yeah.
And when I went through my sort of therapy, it then became quite apparent that there is often something in your past, such as being sexually abused or whatever, that will be the catalyst for something that might seem quite trivial to bring on, you know, the post-traumatic stress. Oh, and in my case, you know, the when I got diagnosed by this, he was a top forensic shrink in the country, funny enough. He sort of said, I don't like doing this, he said, but when we put scales on things, if there was a scale 1 to 10, he said, you've clearly fallen off into the hundreds. He said, that's how bad you are. And I just laughed at him, because I thought, I'm not.
Yeah.
I know I've had me a few moments.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, you know, you need a trauma-focused therapist to be able to help you manage your thoughts and your processes. Yeah. And they can help you, because PTSD can't be cured. It can be managed. And I think that as and when they do find a cure for PTSD, it'll be like the cure for cancer.
Mm.
It will be there, and it'll be an amazing thing. I can't see it happening in my lifetime, but I really hope that it can be. You
it's
know.
So deeply psychological.
Isn't it? It's incredible. So yeah, you know, you look at the way PTSD is and what it does, and it's not something you'll ever get over. It'll always be there. And for me, growing up as a kid, having been abused on a number of occasions, I become very protective towards my brothers and my sister because I was only a baby myself.
Yeah.
And my concern was, as the big brother, and I was probably only about 6 or 7, I'd let them down because I didn't protect them. And I never knew whether it had happened to them.
Yeah.
And then I just went through my life. Whatever I did, I was looking out for everyone else. You know, I'd always find myself in, you know, positions where I was sort of like the focal point. So as a lad, football was my thing. You know, I grew up playing football with Tony Cotty, Tony Adams, Johnny Moncur.
No.
We was all the same. We all played at the same sort of levels. I played semi-pro football before I actually just ran away and joined the army. But I was always like captain and blah, 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 blah. And where I've gone in life and whatever I've done, I've always had that sort of, I don't know why, that position.
Mm.
But I've always looked out for everyone. But, you know, as we said earlier on, you're just putting yourself on the back burner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's sort of like 3 incidences of your top 5.
So there you have it. Part 1 of our episode with Gary Hayes, talking about his experiences with PTSD, ongoing. I don't know how you guys are feeling right now, but it's pretty intense, right, the things that he's seen.
I'm sure they're probably feeling exactly how we felt last night when we recorded that, which was, you know, it was eye-opening, it was thought-provoking, it was sad, it was tragic. He's a roller coaster, right?
Definitely.
And he's got some spirit, which, you know, comes across as well, as I'm sure you're aware. Part 2 will be out shortly, so keep an eye on your listening device to see when that pops up. And the easiest thing to do there is just to subscribe.
Click subscribe.
Once you subscribe, then you don't have to worry about it.
You don't have to worry about it. We know it's on your mind.
And then it just pops up on your listening device. And if you don't want to listen to that episode, then you can just delete it. But it gives you the choice. So, So that's part 2. Enjoy. Will be out soon. See you in a little bit. It's a drunken soiree in the Within. Chris and Stu present Hardcore Listing, the podcast.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.